नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स बुद्धं धम्मं संघं नमस्सामि। So the variety show continues, round two. It's been a lovely retreat so far. I might start just by asking you a question, though. We're about halfway, or a little over halfway through the retreat. Time's flying. How much time have you spent understanding dukkha? Studying dukkha. As I said the other day, it's difficult. Lumpur's referenced all sorts of teachings already, but one of them that came by in the stream that is something I think about a lot is the Buddha talking about this path as a path of effort. The effort ultimately is to support us in the ability to sort of do the unnatural, which is stand under, to receive, to study dukkha, as I said the other day. When the tendency is in the human mind is really just to run away from it, to try to submerge it, minimize it, and most of our energies, if we're honest with ourselves, go into that side of the equation. I can say, even on this very retreat for myself, it's been thoroughly delightful. It's been I can't believe how fast the time is flying by. And I've spent most of the time kind of hanging out in Sukha Vedana as much as I can, interspersed with periods of time going back and licking my wounds. My knees are starting to bear the strain of a little more sitting than I'm used to on a daily basis right now. And that's not entirely inappropriate. I think especially when you have a period like this to be engaging in practice, it's good to front load the period with as much joy and happiness as you can. Helps bring clarity and that kind of strength to then turn the mind towards seeing dukkha, or seeing our dukkha, and particularly how we create dukkha for ourselves. So I was talking about the other day, it's we have to engage in somehow taking it out of the abstract and arriving to this place where we're sensing it directly. I'm always asking myself, how do you do dukkha? How do you do dukkha? And the Buddha says to remedy this problem of suffering, we do thoroughly have to understand the causes and conditions. In some places in the suttas, it talks about it as understanding the arising, the existing or maintenance of it, and the subsiding or cessation of it. And mostly we just want out. We just want it to go away. And we fall back to wanting, wishing, hoping. And I think that's part of what supports, but thinking about it in the abstract, it seems difficult to nurture the conditions where you really can apprehend it. And it's not always so glaringly obvious. There's such a spectrum of how suffering arises. It manifests in just very, very sort of subtle ways. Like sometimes it's just this kind of constriction of selfing, some sort of identification, some sort of half-baked idea that completion is somewhere over there, with just slightly altered conditions. Sometimes you can't even really put words to it. It's like, in over time, you just feel you're off center. You feel very directly this sort of sense that life is incomplete. You're not in a place where you can feel that kind of sense of contentment and gratitude, or even just that sort of sense that life is not problematic. With the body pain, just kind of experimenting with this a little bit. I do this sort of in my day to day life too. Like probably most of you or all of you, there's some sort of habitual pain that the body has, structural pain or some sort of health thing that creates painful sensations. And over the period of retreat, it's not profound, but there's this kind of ache that builds up in my knees or something. And it's interesting sort of as you sort of settle into meditation and you can be in the midst of a mind that feels quite solid with its object of meditation, free from agitation and experiencing even quite a measure of joy and happiness, and that painful cessation is still sort of there in the body. And there's one way where it's creating a kind of dissonance in the mind still. There's a kind of subtle sense of wanting and wishing and hoping that it would go away. And sometimes the way that kind of manifests is, that, as I talked about the other day, is you kind of feel this like it's like picking at a scab or something. Or you constantly sort of making micro adjustments in your posture, either mentally or physically, seeking release from it. And sometimes we get that. I mean, sometimes there's a shift in what's happening physically, or a shift in the mind or something, and there's this profound sort of release or letting go. And the memory of that is strong, and it creates a kind of desire, and you kind of long for that. You long for that experience of mind and body that is just feels completely problematic and at ease. But if you're trying to worm and squiggle your way into it, so I would sort of put that on the side of approaching it sort of in the worldly way. Like there's a skillful way to sort of adjust, and there's this kind of phrase that comes up in several of the suttas where the Buddha's talking about meditation practice that I love. It's like from time to time, give attention to this or that kind of quality. It usually comes in a few different lists where the Buddha's talking about developing meditation, and it is appropriate from time to time to sort of check your posture from time to time. adjust the mind in various ways, adjust your effort, adjust how you're focusing, adjust your attitude. But if you're constantly just trying to rely on that sort of adjustment, then we're often kind of glossing over the opportunity that's staring us right there in the face, which is really just to let go and accept it. And it's especially easy when when we have this kind of space and you've kind of cultivated the meditation practice a bit, to experiment sort of back and forth with the way of the world, which is constantly fiddling, and the way of Dhamma, which is kind of a release through acceptance or through letting go of the desire, just accepting it as it is. And it's interesting when you do that, because the pain is there, but the feeling in the heart is one that is one of full acceptance, or this sense of it being unproblematic, like it's not a problem. So, like Lumpur was talking about the mind at one point. And we oftentimes get into this relationship with our mind, and we're kind of longing for it just to shut up and to be kind of silent and quiet. And I forget exactly how he said it, but he just referenced like developing this sort of attitude of acceptance towards it. Like, that's just the mind. That's what the mind does. And I think it's analogous to this way of relating to painful sensations. You make a determination not to make a problem out of it. It's inevitable that the body experiences aging, illness, and eventually death. And that threaded through the experience of the body is pain. And the question for us as Dhamma practitioners is that a problem? Are we going to let that spoil the kind of freedom or the opportunity for a more purified emotional experience of life? Sometimes I think about it as like arguing with the world, which I find myself doing in all kinds of ways. And it's a fool's errand. Arguing with the world. But in some sense, we argue with our lot in life, with this mind, this body, the causes, conditions that life presents us. And as Dhamma practitioners, we need to, I think, ask ourselves, are you ready just to accept and get on with it? And there is a lot to sort of develop, but I think in some sense some of the path is supported by determinations or making some decisions, and I find it quite effective and powerful in the clarity of practice. Sometimes when you meet some particular pattern of suffering, it can be something's going on in relationship, or it could be the way your life's kind of playing out, or it can be the world, the environment, politics, your health, your aging process. And it's good to ask yourself from time to time, is this worth suffering over? And if it isn't, and you have that kind of moment of clarity, then like actually just making a determination, cutting it off in a sense, or at least giving it a try, to say, no, I'm, you know what, I'm done with creating problem around this. I was meditating the other day and kind of focusing on this pain, this kind of image came up in my mind of like a boat or something, and it's sort of tethered with this kind of old rope, and I have a very kind of graphic sort of imaginary mind, and I just imagine kind of like boom, severing this rope with a sword or a cleaver or something, and just sort of like let it go. Let it just sort of drift off into the ocean, the storm. With that cord, of course, being that kind of holding. And desire really, as a meditator, manifests most strongly in that sort of push and pull of kama chanda, the pull towards wanting the world of the senses to align with our preferences and desires. I think that is the positive side of it. And then the negative is just the aversion, sometimes even manifesting as ill will, which is pushing away, pushing against the world, arguing with the world. But again, it's that worldly sort of way of looking for the blissful, the pleasant, or what I call a sense of completion. The life in the world, and the kind of feeling of samsara is that of incompleteness. And I often kind of think about this practice, like I ask myself sometimes, could you walk away from this? Could you give it up? Having been a monk for 20 some years now, I wonder if that would be possible, like just to kind of give it up. And I don't know, I could become a study monk or not care about practice in some way. And I don't think I could manage it, because it just seems to be so much to be the kind of I don't have language for it. I want to say our birthright. And I don't believe in destiny, but it just seems that if you really tune into sort of the experience and the way the Dhamma encourages us, that by nature beings seek this sense of completion, whether they have this language of Dhamma and Dukkha or not. I think all beings sense their experience is threaded with this sense of incompleteness, or it feels problematic. And I think of us as orienting towards that which feels like it's taking us to a potential place of happiness or completion. Most often we confuse that with pleasure. So we seek that which is happy and pleasurable. That is the common strategy of at least animals and human beings. I don't know about the rest of it. Constantly sort of scanning the horizon for potential pleasurable experiences. I was just walking outside, and I was walking through the grass, and as I got close to this, and it felt really nice, kind of just wet, and I was walking barefoot, and it sort of felt really nice on my feet, just sort of like wet and sort of fresh. And then as I walked into the sort of shaded part of the grass near the building or something, it felt cold, because the sun hadn't warmed it up. And immediately I just felt like pushed sort of a few feet back out where the sun had warmed the grass out. And I thought, that's just silly. How fussy we are, how much we're just pulled to something that's just that much better, you know. It's like 0.02% more comfortable walking over there. And it was, but it felt like somebody kind of like pushing me or pulling me sort of in that direction, you know. I had to kind of convince myself not to be moved by it. I said, come on, just keep walking. But in some sense, that gives me kind of great hope, because, you know, there are days and there are times, if we're engaged in this practice for any length of time, where we do doubt ourselves and we do kind of question where we're going or where we'll get to or what's even possible in this practice for us. And for me, rather than seeing it as a discouraging thing, I see it as very hopeful that there is this deep, deep, deep desire in living beings to find their real home, if you will, or to orient towards that which is complete. And so one way of training ourselves and being a student of dukkha is to become very sort of sensitive to that dissonance that arises in the heart, that sense that life feels somehow incomplete or problematic. And to do the counterintuitive thing and stop and create some clarity so that you can like feel that in a way that's appropriate and ask yourself, why? What's wrong? What do I really want here? What do I expect here? I guess when we study the second noble truth, the Buddha says that lack, that sense of incompleteness, that sense of dissonance, if we use that to talk about dukkha, has its root in thirsting, has its root in desire avijja tanha, an ignorant, an unskilled, unenlightened way of thirsting in the world is the source of that. So there is something you want. I like this word thirst because it's so physical. Like, you know, think about when you're thirsty. It's not just like you want a drink when you're thirsty. It's like your whole body wants it. And that's the feeling of desire. It creates that sense that life is incomplete without the object that it's foolishly desiring or longing for. Switching tracks just a little bit, last night in the questions, there was a question about practicing with the sound of silence. And when Lumpur sort of said, well, I don't really do this so much, I thought, oh, great, I can talk about that tomorrow. But then he went on to sort of talk about it. But I thought I'd talk about it just a little bit, because it is a practice that I've used, and it's not my main practice. My main practice is breath meditation, and although there's all kinds of auxiliary meditations I do, somehow I always end up back at the breath. But there's periods of time where I focused on this practice, inspired by Ajahn Sumedho and Ajahn Amaro's talks on the subject matter. And I find it uniquely useful practice in a few different ways. There was a time where I was really, when I was still a monk in Thailand, where I was trying to make this my main meditation for a while, and really kind of exploring it and seeing, you know, what the nature of that sound meditation was and where you could take it. And something I like about it is I think it's rather difficult to use that to develop deep states of concentration. There's something about the nature of attending to it that I found kind of difficult. But rather than seeing it as a flaw, I kind of see that as something of a strength that it has. And so over the years, I've tended to use it as a preliminary meditation, or something that kind of access in certain situations or through the day. It's a very nice kind of practice for just kind of anchoring or grounding the mind, especially in the midst of maybe work or driving or even conversation. If you practice with it on some regular basis, you can access it. I find you can access it a lot easier than following your breath. So, like, I cannot follow my breath and talk at the same time. I believe that theoretically it might be possible. But it's fairly easy to establish that sort of reference point of the sound of silence and then continue sort of talking or continue kind of listening to somebody. And it provides this kind of like anchoring or ballast for the mind, so that the mind isn't so thrown into the habitual sort of patterns that we have when we're sort of thinking about things or responding to speech. And something I think it's very useful for is just practicing sort of listening. Like you're listening for this tone. But in some sense, like this work of trying to sort of sensitize ourselves to our habits of dukkha, I think is greatly supported by developing a kind of deep ability just to listen. In some sense, samadhi really supports that. It's like, you know, as we develop sort of samadhi based on the breath or any sort of object, it gets us to this place where we can listen very deeply to our experience. But with the sound of silence, you know, without going into a state of samadhi, it kind of puts you into that sort of posture where, you know, you're opening the mind up in a way that's very spacious and attentive. Sound is such a ephemeral sort of thing. I think much more than sight. It's like when you really just open the ears up and you're like not listening for anything in particular, that sound becomes fairly easily to discern. And while you're listening to that, you can also hear the contents of your mind in a way, and it sets you up into that sort of open sort of posture where sounds are flowing, and so are sensations and ideas. And there's this base or this kind of reference point that keeps you from being sort of swept away, caught up into the reactions or the content of the thoughts or reactions to the sense impressions. I find it particularly good when you sit down to meditate and the mind feels like it's just too restless. Like sometimes you've been engaged in a lot of conversation or you've had a very busy day and you sit down to sort of meditate, the mind feels literally like it's just shaking. And there's all kinds of voices and thoughts just bouncing off, bouncing around in the mind. And at those times, I find it a bit difficult to sort of catch the breath when restlessness is strong and there's been a lot of sense impingement throughout the day. Sometimes it's difficult just to sit down and connect with the breath right away. And rather than struggling with it, I find sort of turning to the sound of silence is a very useful sort of preliminary meditation to start to deal with that sort of restlessness. Because there's an interest in creating that sort of space. It's something like the attitude, again, that Lumpur was talking about. You know, rather than getting stuck in some sort of posture of aversion, like, oh God, my mind, it's just such a mess. There's all these sounds and thoughts and ideas bouncing around from the conversations and the... instead of slipping into that or just trying to sort of tackle it or suppress it, it's almost like you turn 180 and just sort of say, okay, go. just hold the awareness sort of with that sort of sound, sort of high-pitched bass kind of sound of silence. And in time, I find the mind just starts to quiet down quite naturally. At first, maybe the sound of thought is frequent and busy and bouncing all over the place, but in time it's kind of like more and more space kind of develops in the mind, things kind of slow down, and then at some point I can hear my breath. I can feel and hear the breath, and without leaving the sound of silence, just easily transition into encompassing both the sound of silence and the motion and sensations of the breath also moving through that space in the mind. And I don't sort of think about it purely as listening to the breath. Listening more in that sort of sense of being just completely receptive. And I think that's part of the value of that practice, is it's a way to sort of strengthen that sort of ability to be receptive and to move into a posture that's very kind of still and grounded and receptive. And then oftentimes what I do is just couple the keep that sort of baseline of the sound of silence there and feel the breath. And then spend time just tuning in to and noticing the other sensations that are arising and ceasing, the various sense impressions. And then generally at some time, I just drop it and switch over to doing breath meditation. It might be 5 minutes. It might be 15 minutes. It's rarely a half hour. But I find it's just a really nice way to sort of work with restlessness. Or if there is, even if the mind isn't restless, sometimes it's a wonderful way for me to just begin a meditation to sort of heighten that sense of receptivity to what's going on in the mind. It's very easy to sort of approach our meditation in a way that is habitual, a bit mechanical, kind of ritualized. And so occasionally I like just to use this kind of sound of silence to sort of just break that up a little bit and sort of open the mind up, rather than trying to sort of just absorb and become engrossed in the sensations of the breath. So I had a thought to talk about the bhujangas, but maybe I'll just leave it at that for tonight. Sadhu, sadhu.